What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including an alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Look who's here. It's Kate Willett.
It's a double Catherine show.
It's a Catherine squared. Kate Willett is the co-host of the Reply Guys podcast. She's also the author of a very good audio book called Dirtbag Anthropologist.
Anthropology. And I'm also a Catherine.
Anthropologist. Yeah. And she's also a Catherine. Is your middle name Rose?
But similar vibes.
Right, we did that. Yeah, similar vibes. Yeah. Except one of us is Jewish, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah. The blonde one, though.
I know. I guess I am blonde, which is also weird. Someone once accused me of stolen valor because I had blonde hair.
It looks great.
Thanks.
Honestly, it's perfect.
Oh, we got a hater in the chat. And let me tell you something, hater. Why don't you cough up some money and I'll actually read your hate mail. I don't know what your deal is. I'm not going to look at it anymore. Just someone let me know if it gets into Super Chat, and then we can talk to this guy. I get the sense that he's a dude. What do I know? I don't want to typecast my trolls. They could be anything.
Can I make fun of one tiny piece of this comment, or should I not reveal anything?
Yeah, sure, do it.
I think he meant to call you a scatterbrain, but he actually called you a scatterbrian.
Come on, man. If you're going to call me, look, you have cause. I mean, I'm literally putting on one of my other earrings right now, but you can't really pull that. You just lost all your cred because you called someone scatterbrained, but you like were scatterbrained in your.
This is Scatterbrain. This man.
Right. Now we know what his real name is.
Scatterbrain.
We have an amazing show for you today. We have a couple of amazing parts of it. First of all, we have Kate Willett.
Hello.
I keep wanting to call her Kate Winslet.
Some people have.
Have, right? And then we're going to have Kshama Sawant, who is amazing. She's a city councilwoman in Seattle. She's doing absolutely amazing things. And then we're going to have Adolph Reed, who does absolutely amazing things. I did a little stream last night, last minute. Everyone liked what Joe Biden had to say. What did you think of it, Kate?
I was comparing it to the Oscars, and I thought that the costumes were much worse for the State of the Union, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, not as cute. Also, I did want to say really quickly that I have gotten trolled as Kate Winslet sometimes. And I've had like random internet men be like, you look so fucking fat in Titanic, which I think is funny.
Shut up. Are they blind now? Did they get blind since seeing Titanic and seeing you? Are you visible to them? I don't even understand.
I think they're just really dumb. Really dumb. Yeah, they're scatterbrains. Yeah.
You know who kept looking like he was collapsing was Manchin. And Mitt Romney looked like a hot mess. He looked like he just got caught in a – he looked like he had sunstroke. There's a lot going on.
There's always a lot going on with him. Yeah, I thought the Pelosi and Kamala had the like pink and blue duo, which was very, you know, very trad in a way.
Yeah, so, stronger together.
Stronger together.
Stronger together. It. You know, we're building back better. We're building back better from before. Yeah.
I saw today something. I saw someone retweeted an account called Twitter Together. Was like an official Twitter account that was like, keep your feminism intersectional.
Oh my God. Yeah. Did Will Manicker tweet it?
That must have been who it was. Yeah.
You know what? I got to say something that I went to that account because I was so curious about it. And that's how I found out that this month is, guess what month this is? International
April.
blank month. Well, in addition to April.
Oh, okay. International.
I don't think you'll guess. And when you don't guess, I'm going to say it's because you invisibilize them.
Mimes,
you said?
Yeah, I was just thinking of who it was easy to invisibilize because you just close your eyes and they're gone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Is it Asian American? I don't know. But I'll tell you whose it is. I tweeted it out, guys. So if you are really follow my tweets, you'd know this already. But I'm going to forgive you. Dalit. International Dalit Month. Dalit, who, you know, formerly known as Untouchables in India.
Oh, okay.
Very, very rich and ignored history. In fact, I'm going to have someone on to talk about that history. If my computer blew up right now, it would be fine because we already did such a great show. Yeah, where else can you find this out? I bet you no other stream is going to mention. Well, no other stream on this continent. That's probably too much of a stretch. No, I bet you no other stream tonight will mention that it's Dalit Awareness Month. Let me actually get the actual name of it. Dalit Month. On Bedekar, Dalit History Month. That's what it is. Dalit History Month. Okay? Very important. God, it is really... It was inspired by Black History Month. Inspired by Black History Month, a young group of Dalit women started the Dalit History Month in... Guess how recent it is. Guess.
How? 6 years?
Almost. 8. 2013?
Oh, that was close.
2013, yeah. That is really close. I would have thought longer. Sangha Pali Aruna started Project Dalit History Month for creating a documentation of Dalit, Adivasi, and Bahajan history and culture. Sangha Pali Aruna and Thenmozi Soundarajan came up with the idea during discussions at Color of Violence Conference in Chicago. Wow. And just so people know, Dalits are discriminated because of their caste. I'm reading from Wikipedia, but I think we'll find out if it's true or not later. Because of their caste, despite such discrimination being illegal in India, ignorance and absence of Dalits in Indian history by mainstream authors is discussed during Dalit History Month. Issues faced by Dalits are pondered upon by citizens. All right, cool. I'm glad this is a thing. And we're going to have to, I only have a couple of days. In fact, I think I have 2 days put together a show during Dalit History Month. A lot of pressure I just created for myself.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, we're going to pause this story because I want everyone in suspense, but also because we have our next guest. And if she's ready, she can give me the thumbs up. Okay. Of course she's ready. She's ready for everything. She's ready for, not ready for Hillary. We're not ready for Hillary either, but she's ready for a lot of things. Very impressive. Very impressive person. You know her. You love her. She is a city councilwoman from Seattle, and she is a total badass and does more as a city council woman, city council person, than a lot of people do as senators or members of Congress. So, Kshama Sawant, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Hey, Sama.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Welcome. Thank you for all you do. I just wanted to have people find out about your latest endeavor. Congratulations on your resolution. And then we can talk about what's happening in your campaign. But welcome. Tell us about the exciting news about what just passed.
On Monday, the city council passed by 7-1 the resolution that my office brought in solidarity with the movement globally, in fact, not just citywide or region-wide, but globally, that is demanding that Biden and other powerful countries in the World Trade Organization allow countries like India, South Africa, Brazil, so on, to produce generic versions of the COVID-19, you know, the life-saving vaccine, because at this moment, the status quo is that billions of people across the world are not going to get access to the vaccine for years. And in the process, literally millions of lives will be lost. This is what public health experts are predicting. And all of this because billionaires and big pharma executives want to put their obscene and endless greed for profit before human lives. And that's why it was so crucial that we passed this resolution. And today we had a press conference alongside Chicago socialist alderman Brian Sicchio-Lopez and Burbank City Council member Constantine Anthony, who are also planning to bring such resolutions to their city council. And tomorrow we're having a protest in Seattle outside the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation building. Why? Because Bill Gates is one of those billionaires who is putting his own profit before people. And in fact, as a community member said, he's become a vaccine racketeer now.
Yeah.
A vaccine racketeer, yeah. A vacketeer. True. So does this have any, is this mostly symbolic? Is this to start a conversation? Does it have any teeth? What are you hoping to achieve with it?
Well, obviously, because this is a city council, we don't have legal jurisdiction. We cannot mandate that Biden administration or U.S. Congress do a certain thing. But here's why it's so important is because even though 100 nations in the WTO are saying that you need to, this is apocalyptic. I mean, if you look at what's happening in India, for example, an apocalyptic disaster is unfolding. And yet it is requiring us to demand that Biden do the right thing. And it's important to also note that even after 100 days of the Biden administration in office, this is a continuation of Donald Trump's policy. And that's why this resolution has significance, because it gives momentum to the movement to keep fighting.
Right. And it's kind of pathetic that, like, this is the first we're here. I mean, this is it's amazing, but it's also pathetic that this is what is getting this into the news. Like, there was this article about Bill Gates, but people don't even know that what you're talking about is a thing or that it's an option. And I think something that's really inspiring about your activism. It's funny because you're actually an elected official, which it's like I almost forget because you do such cool things, and usually elected officials stop doing that. But you know, something that's so cool about your activism and organizing and also councilship, I guess, is that you really do show people that other things are possible. You know, like another world is possible. And I think a lot of people really dismiss things as just like Pollyanna-ish or naive or impossible. And one of the things that I think you do, Sanders did, really is like show people that we've been taught that, but that's not the actual reality. Like, you can make demands for things. So what would this look like, or could this look like? Because a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, there'll be no incentive to work on drugs or medical treatment.
This is the narrative that is very consciously and systematically pumped every day into the corporate media. And whose interest is this narrative, this falsehood in? It's in the interest of billionaires like Bill Gates, basically the billionaire class, the multimillionaires who make profits. But the reality could not be farther from the truth, right? We know that the overwhelming majority of clinical innovations and indeed technological innovations in general happen because of public resources. And who pays for the public resources? It's ordinary people. If you're watching this and you depend on a salary for paying your rent or your mortgage, then you're one of the taxpayers whose resources have funded this enormously important life-saving clinical research. And who does the research? It's not the billionaires who do the research. It's salaried employees, you know, researchers, technicians, clinical analysts, who are salaried employees who are extremely dedicated and they care about solving this problem. And most of this research is done in public universities. And once the findings are ready, once the cures are ready, what happens? Big pharma, and this is how capitalism operates, big pharma comes, swoops down, big billionaires swoop down and grab what the so-called intellectual property, and then they make bank from it. I mean, it is obscene, as I said before, the amount of money that these billionaires and these shareholders and executives are making from this vaccine. And this is on top of billionaires having become already more than $1 trillion richer during the pandemic. So we're not just talking about Big Pharma. We're talking about Amazon. We're talking about Jeff Bezos, all of them, all of these gangsters who are profiting at the cost of human suffering. And so this whole idea that you would take away the incentive, it is such a lie. But the thing is, a system like capitalism needs to peddle lies, because otherwise people will be empowered.
Right. They get hip to it. They'd be aware of what was happening. Yeah,
exactly.
By the way, this is another, I literally was saying today earlier, I wasn't planning to, but we started talking about, what was it, Kate? Like Twitter change or something? Twitter for good?
Oh, Twitter together. Yeah.
Twitter together, yeah, which yeah. I came across. And then I was looking at their account, and that's how I learned that this month is month. And I'm bringing that up because I was just on your Twitter page, and lo and behold, I got to share this because this is really cool too. You had tweeted this.
Anil Wagde. His name is Anil Wagde.
Spoke today on behalf of Indians _ Seattle in a press conference with council member Kshama Sawant, held after the Seattle City Council passed a resolution urging POTUS to end the U.S. opposition to an intellectual property rights waiver for COVID-19 vaccines. So that's like really amazing. And I was going to actually ask you about the connection for you between being from India and this issue, but I would love to know the connection between this issue and being from India, and also like what if anything the Dalit like experience or history has to do with this.
Yeah, absolutely. The organization that tweeted this out, the Ambedkar related organization, it refers to Baba Saheb Ambedkar, who was a prominent thinker and activist and revolutionary fighter during India's freedom struggle in the first half of the 20th century. And Ambedkar himself was from a Dalit family, which is one of the lowest castes, the people who are the most oppressed in India. And that's, hundreds of millions of people. And the question of Dalit oppression is so crucial for us, for the left internationally, including in the United States, for various reasons. One is obviously the most immediate things that we see. In fact, even in the tech industry, actually in the United States, in fact, there's a class action lawsuit right now that has been filed in California, in the state of California, where tech workers from Dalit backgrounds are facing discrimination by upper caste Indians in the tech sector. So it's alive and well. Unfortunately, you can see that, that evil is brought across the seas. But it's of much more fundamental importance because it's also a revelation of how the global system of capitalism operates. A system like capitalism, where a few people enrich themselves to untold degrees at the expense of billions of people, and the rest of humanity, that system can only survive through very systematic and centuries-long divide-and-conquer strategy. And one of the ways in which it manifests itself is through oppression based on race, oppression based on caste. And so obviously the Dalit oppression in India is not, it's not like it's the processes are a carbon copy of what you see in the US or in other countries, but the fundamental process is the same, which is a deeply oppressive system like feudalism, like capitalism, requires such oppressions, and not just, oppressions, pre-existing oppressions, but continue to fuel them and reignite them through newly conducted violence. All of that is necessary. And so it's not surprising to us that we see racism and police violence to such a degree in the United States. And again, in India, you see just systematic violence being targeted at the Dalit community. And that's why I think for me, as somebody who grew up in India and who's a Marxist in the United States, I think it's always a reminder for me that this is really an international struggle. And ultimately, the international working class, the global working class, has to unite for a struggle against the global system of capitalism. And we have more in common with working people across, across continents than with other, American billionaires who might live a few blocks from here.
Right. And of course, it's hard to organize around that, though, right? How do we organize around that when there are different laws? You know, big issue, like Biden kept, you know, sounded like a major cold warrior last night, except against China, a little up against Russia, but really almost exclusively against China. But, you know, that's a big issue, is like how to deal with people leaving the country, you know, shipping out jobs so that the pay is lower. And then, of course, that creates a lot of like anti-solidarity because people are divided and conquered and pitted against each other. So what kind of solutions can we be fighting for?
I think fundamentally our starting point and the political analysis is of crucial importance. I mean, we're not navel gazers, right? We're activists. We are here to make actual change. We want, as long as we are alive, we want that we want our lives to be used to bring about material shifts in human life and actually fight the climate crisis. But all of that has to be based on a very sound political analysis. And the starting point is exactly what we were talking about a few seconds before, which is that without an internationalist understanding of capitalism, it is simply impossible to actually build those kinds of links. As you were saying, that's a challenge. How do you build those links? And I think we have to base ourselves on an understanding of why we need international working class solidarity. And then the other component of that is, of course, the class aspect, that it has to be on the basis of uniting oppressed people together on a working class basis, understanding. So, you know, lesson number two, first one is, of course, that this is international. Lesson number two is you don't build solidarity with the bosses, with the billionaires, or any of the institutions or individuals who represent their interests, which is why, you know, Socialist Alternative and I are, strongly arguing that we cannot build movements and really build for change with inside the Democratic Party. We need, working people need a party of our own. I guess the third point I'll add to in response to your question is that the best way really and the most concrete way to build for this kind of international solidarity in addition to the step one and step two is then to get involved in struggles in our own cities and regions and then connect them to nationwide and international struggles. And just one concrete example I'll end on is the $15 an hour minimum wage. You know, our Move 15 Now movement here, which won just 6 months after I took office, that happened because of the working class solidarity and the fighting politics of the 15 Now movement based on a socialist strategy. And by winning that, we showed that we should not accept the nationwide and international race to the bottom and allow them to pit working people against one another, but instead flip that on its head and say, we're going to win $15 here because guess what? It is going to help working people win in Minneapolis, Boston, New York. Suddenly we're talking about federal $15 minimum wage. It also actually sparked movements in the UK and in India. So that's how we build, like by fighting against the race to the bottom everywhere.
Yeah. Kate, did you have a question? I saw you about to, I have more questions, but if you had, I wanted to give you a chance.
Well, this is back to something a couple minutes ago, but from what I understand, it's not just an issue of IP with the vaccines. Like, isn't the Biden administration, aren't they trying to actively prevent the export of the materials needed to make the vaccines? In some cases, prevent India from even, like, they already have the materials there and they're not allowed to use it for their own population.
It's all of it. So the last thing that you said, Paige, that even if you have materials, you're not allowed to do it, that's because of the patents. You know, it's like saying you can't use this formula, you can't have access to the formula because you need the recipe, so to say, to make the vaccine. And without these removing these patent restrictions, which is what this resolution was all about, you can't do that. But you're also right about the other thing that you said, that in the sense that we need these patent restrictions to be removed immediately, but that's a necessary first step. That by itself is not going to do it. We also need raw materials to be able to produce it. And in fact, this latest announcement by Biden, where he finally relented and is allowing India to have some materials, two points to be noted about that. One, it took an international struggle and an outcry from activists to make that happen. It wasn't like Biden woke up and said, I'm going to do the right thing. Yeah. No, it took a lot of international pressure to make that happen. And furthermore, you can see from a lot of experts that there is a discussion really about what is it that they even allow to be exported? Is it even the main materials that are needed? So in other words, there is so much of detail in all of this, all of these issues, that it's not even clear to me at this point that they have actually released the materials that need to be released, the most important ones. So in other words, what we need is both the intellectual property restrictions to be removed and for all the materials that are needed for the most widely tested vaccines, for those vaccines to have generic versions to be produced so that billions of people can get vaccinated and in the process save millions of lives. So all of that is needed.
And can you talk about the recall campaign?
Yes. So not surprisingly, because our office has been unwaveringly fighting for and alongside working class movements, we have actually, as you said, Katie, earlier, we are not a typical politician. We use our office to build movements and we win victories. We have such an unparalleled track record at this point. So it's no surprise that big business and the right wing and indeed the Democratic Party establishment itself is so done with us. They want us out of here. And so there is a recall campaign directed against us. In fact, this recall campaign was launched literally just months after we won our second re-election campaign in 2019. And in that campaign itself, as many of your viewers might know, Amazon and the Chamber of Commerce went all out to try and defeat us. And in fact, in the primary election, two of the Latina so-called progressive council members, Democrats themselves, ran a candidate against us with this whole false narrative, you know, the civility politics all narrative that, saying, oh, I agree with someone's policies. I just don't think she knows how to build relationships. Right. And I think that is not an empty accusation. What it reflects is the fact that big business and their political representatives, they do want relationships. They want politicians to bend, elected representatives to bend to their agenda. And when you don't bend to their agenda, then you are described as not being civil, not having good relationships. Yeah. So it should be a badge of honor that they are using these accusations, because what they're really saying, the subtext is that they are fearful of the movements we built. And they don't want to deal with it anymore. They couldn't defeat us in an election. So now they're using underhanded tactics. And just one other thing is everybody who's watching should know that the Washington State recall law itself is set up to go after working class representatives, because the law itself does not require that the charges that are made against me be true. That the truth does not have to be proven. It's not like I get to go to court and defend myself. The charges just have to be stated properly or something like that. I mean, it's set up to go after working class representatives.
Yeah. And are you like getting a lot of support? What can people do? Is this the right link, by the way? I put in the ksamasolidarity.org.
Yes.
Is that okay?
That's,
yes. So what can people do? And besides like spreading the word, what is it that you need from people?
Well, certainly spreading the word is really crucial because a lot of what you're saying is already indicating this is an attack not against an individual or even one socialist council office. This is intended to have a chilling effect on social movements and the labor movement as a whole and on the socialist movement, obviously. And if they succeed in recalling our office, then they will absolutely be more emboldened to go after movement. So we all on the left, progressives, we actually have a stake in fighting against this recall and winning against this recall. So we certainly need support from all corners of this country. We also need financial contributions because obviously the billionaires are donating to the other side.
Right.
So we need working people.
The list of billionaires that are part of the recall campaign, it's, you know, you've got a whole red carpet full of kind of ugly dudes coming after you. So, yeah.
You should definitely put that on your website. You should have like a Hall of Fame.
Hall of Shame. It is a Hall of Shame. And you're totally right. It's a who's who of these CEOs and billionaires and multimillionaires. And in fact, you know, one other thing that I was reminded of is that it's not only, obviously, it's Amazon and, you know, the usual suspects, but also a whole host of these, who are going to be belonging in the Hall of Shame are real estate barons.
Of course.
And You know, and that's not, again, that's not surprising to us at all, because we have won just unprecedented numbers of renters' rights victories. In fact, just 3 days before the Supreme Court ruled that the recall could go ahead, we won a huge victory for renters, which is for all renters facing eviction to have the right to a publicly funded lawyer. And the establishment was absolutely against it. They tried all kinds of underhanded ways to insert really insidious means testing loopholes. They didn't win because we built such a fiery campaign against it. And then 3 days later, the recall says, it's fair to recall someone, you know, our office, even though we are fighting for it. But it's no surprise. There's a link, you know, corporate landlords and property management corporations do not like what we've done.
Yeah. You welcome their hatred. FDR said, and then Bernie said. What else? I wanted to make sure you have the chance to talk about whatever you want to talk about, because, you're in an important moment. I have more questions for you, but
ask me questions.
Want to know your thoughts on the celebration of Kamala Harris as Black and also South Asian. Her father's Jamaican. He's very, in a really cool, chill way, kind of, I don't know if he's disavowed her, but after she, on the Breakfast Club, when they asked if she had ever smoked pot, she was like, yeah, my family's Jamaican. And the dad was like, I'm glad that your ancestors aren't alive to see this. He's a Marxist professor. He's a Marxist economist himself. And her mother, of course, is from India. And I want to know what you thought of the discussion about her background.
I think that it's a good example of how somebody's personal identity cannot be a guarantee, and is not indeed a guarantee, that they will actually stand for the interests of the vast majority of the community that is represented by their identity. In other words, if you look at the Biden administration as a whole, and obviously Kamala Harris is very prominent because she's the vice president, but if you look at his whole cabinet, there are so many individuals who are people of color. But just to name one of them, Cedric Richmond, so-called liaison on climate fossil fuel issues. I mean, the guy is the biggest recipient of fossil fuel money. And his district in Louisiana includes and encompasses one of the, I think, the 10
Cancer
most...
Cancer Alley or something?
Yeah, 10 most exactly polluted tracks in the United States. This is absolutely scandalous. So because Cedric Richmond is Black, does he represent the interests of the vast majority of Black and people of color communities who are on the front lines of the ravages of the climate crisis, not to mention the specific Black communities who were destroyed in Hurricane Katrina? Absolutely not. So in the same sense, you know, Kamala Harris might be half Black American, but she was the one, wasn't she the one who boasted about being the top cop? And so I think we have to evaluate, you know, obviously, it is completely necessary. And also it is our fundamental moral and political obligation on the left, especially the socialist left, to be actively fighting against oppression. It is important that so many of us were marching shoulder to shoulder with our community members in the Black Lives Matter protests. And the fight against oppression is not a side issue. It is very much part and parcel of the fight against capitalism. But we have to understand that is going to happen. I mean, that fight is going to be successful if we understand that we're not going to address Black oppression, for example, on the basis of some idea of Black capitalism. That is not going to be the savior, because, you know, we should remember Malcolm X's words. You can't have capitalism without racism. In other words, capitalism is the system that creates these oppressions. And so the fight against Black oppression has to be linked to the fight against capitalism itself. And so we cannot rely on the representatives of the interests of capitalism, whatever skin color they might be. And we're seeing that in real life, even in Seattle, like if you go from Congress to Seattle, the Seattle City Council is majority women of color and super majority women. And yet, even today, where is the fight? The fight is with my office and the working class movement fighting to win the Amazon tax, fighting to defund the police, fighting to get renters, public funding for attorneys when they're facing eviction, fighting for all of these things. And so ultimately, the identity is not the guarantee. Which side are they on in terms of the class lines? That matters.
Right. Representation is important, but it's necessary but insufficient. And as we can see frequently, it's actually can be used as a distraction. This I want to just show this tweet, which was amazing. Speaking of Cedric Richmond, so when Cedric Richmond was named, Sunrise Movement rightfully expressed disappointment, right? Because they wanted a zero fossil fuel, zero corporate, zero Wall Street, zero corrupt, whatever. Pledge, which they obviously didn't get. And so they released a statement, and Jonathan Martin had the gall. He's a reporter at the New York Times. And I love that he actually tweeted this thing out loud visibly. 21 preview, picking a fight from the start with the most influential black staffer in the White House who represented an energy heavy district. And then he quotes Sunrise Movement. Cedric Richmond's hire is betrayal due to big oil ties and silence on pollution in his district. It's so heavy-handed. Be a little bit more subtle. You're basically just saying this person is black and influential. Why are you complaining about him? Also, he lives in an energy-heavy district. And it reminds me a bit of the whole, that trope of it's easy to be progressive when you're a straight white man that we saw a lot in 2016, and wanted to know your thoughts on that.
What you just said about, it's easy to be progressive if you're a white man. I mean, such attacks were leveled at Bernie Sanders. And if you look at who some of his big support bases were, it was young women. It was black community members. It was people who understood that really this system is not working for them and that they need this kind of program. For example, the things that Bernie was talking about, taxing Wall Street to make universities free and to have Medicare for all, to actually, to cancel student debt. So if you look at all these policies, the $15 an hour minimum wage, the Democrats have completely sold out on the federal $15 minimum wage. Well, who do we think are going to be the most benefited by the $15 minimum wage? It is communities of color. It is women. It is our immigrant workers. And so when they say that, you cannot criticize somebody who is a person of color, but that we are also the people who are not going to let you win 15. Well, whose interests are they upholding? They're not upholding the interests of black community members. They're upholding the interests of Wall Street. Let's be clear.
Yeah. Any final thoughts that you have? I know you're super busy. I got to have another chat with you once. I want to do it. I'm so curious about your life and your story. We'll have to do that another time, pre-taped. But anything else? Someone asked about your thoughts on the PRO Act. What did you think about Biden's speech yesterday? It's great to know that he nominally supports $15 an hour, but I guess he had to step aside because that parliamentarian.
Parliamentarian that nobody had heard about.
Yeah,
I know.
And
then suddenly that was the most important piece of the puzzle. Yeah, I think we one last thing I'll say, and I'll be delighted to be back on your show whenever you want me back. But the thing is, it's crucial to understand that people are understandably, myself included, absolutely relieved that the Trump administration has ended. And it was important that voters in America delivered that strong repudiation of his reactionary policies. And at the same time, it's important to understand that the stimulus package, all of the other, even the childcare benefits, all of this is crucial. At this moment, it is a lifeline in people's lives. That those policies had to be enacted, one, on because Biden and the Democrats face the pressure of being different than Donald Trump, and also because they want to save their own system that is in deep, deep crisis. Unprecedented crisis. So it's important that they did it, but also we have to understand why they did it. It was not out of beneficence, but it's because they're being forced to. And so we can see that that is why they're doing only what's necessary and nothing more than that. So you think that the Democratic establishment is going to easily pass $15 an hour? No, Are they going to do Medicare for all? Hell no, not without a fight. And so, you know, ultimately, we have to build mass movements, and the labor movement has to be a crucial component of it. And then not to mention the two crises that are staring us in the face. One is immediately going to hit people now as the eviction moratoriums start coming to a close, is the tsunami of evictions that is going to go up. I mean, the statistics are stunning. As soon as there's even a bit of news of economic recovery, corporate landlords and all the big real estate guns, they are just chomping at the bit. Already rent increases are back, you know, the increases themselves are back to stratospheric levels. And then the other issue that we should talk about in more detail sometime later is the issue of climate change. I mean, this the climate crisis is I mean, it's just to give you one statistic. During the pandemic year, when energy use had plummeted because people were not flying, you know, people were stay at home, we saw during this pandemic year, 60 of the largest global banks underwrite nearly $4 trillion worth of new fossil fuel projects. These are new $4 trillion. So not only, it's not as if, oh, it's bad news, we are not fast enough on track to change. No, the bad news is that we are going the other way. We are, the planet is going off the cliff. And this is not hyperbole. This is not exaggeration. This is real. And so the question of building, you know, urgently building independent mass movements, meaning mass movements independent of the establishment and big business, that is so real. And, you know, I would love to for us to go more into that.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have to have you back. Someone asked if you ever plan to run for state legislature. And then I want to, final question is, you are now a dual citizen, I believe, of Socialist Alternative and DSA. So how is that?
Sorry, what was that? How is that? Or what is?
Oh, you're a dual citizen of those two, right? So yes. What's it like? Is it disorienting? Do you feel like the same person?
Yeah, I do.
And then someone asked if you're going to run for state legislature.
You know, what we do in the future obviously depends on what we feel is in the best interest of building the larger movement. And, you know, so that's why I don't have a yes or no answer, in the sense that it's not my personal decision. Even running for city council was not my personal decision. Socialist Alternative as a whole, you know, we are a democratic organization where our members discuss, debate, and vote on every crucial decision for our organization, you know, including should we run a campaign, what the campaign platform should be, who the candidate should be. And to be brutally honest, if it was left to me, would I choose this? No, of course not. I mean, I don't want to be in the spotlight. But the point is that is actually we should not. You know, it's the model I'm describing that Socialist Alternative uses, I think, is a very healthy approach to politics, because it is the complete opposite of personality and career-based politics. This is movement-based politics, where we are crystal clear that if we win an office, it is for building the working class movement, for building the socialist movement. It is absolutely not about any one person's career. And so, again, it's not a coincidence that I only take home an average worker's wage and the rest of my salary goes into a solidarity fund after taxes.
And why awesome. Did you join, by the way, DSA? What are you hoping to achieve by being a member of both organizations?
Yeah, so so your viewers know, I mean, I was I joined recently, but many of my fellow members of Socialist Alternative have already become members for years. I mean, they've been members for years. So yeah, it just became news because I joined. But the reason many of us have joined, and not all of our members have joined DSA, some of our members have joined DSA, but the reason we have joined is because we believe, first of all, that both the growth in DSA and the growth in Socialist Alternative, all of this reflects that we are in a completely changed period where there are huge openings for building not just movements in general, which is absolutely true, but also specifically the socialist movement. And we see the growth in DSA in a very positive light. It's important that this happening. But we also feel that Socialist Alternative has a role to play in the debates that are to come. And we have to have serious discussions, you know, what should be the program for the socialist movement on climate, addressing the climate crisis? What kind of election campaign should we run? What kind of candidates do we need? What kind of demand should we put on our candidates? What kind of a working class party do we need in order for as a political vehicle for future movements. So these are all very serious questions for the socialist movement. And we believe Socialist Alternative has many valuable contributions to make and also learn from. You know, we want to engage in that debate. But we want to engage in a politicized debate. We're not interested in any kind of personality conflict or anything like that, because we feel that these serious debates are going to be crucial because they will provide the building blocks of the analysis that we need for our future activism.
Awesome. Great.
It's awesome.
Well, thank you so much. Definitely come back. Love to have you on again. You're always so great to talk to, and you inspire everyone. So, well, all the good people. You inspire everyone. You inspire haters who suck, are going to be in the hall of shame, and then you inspire the good people. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Paige, Katie. Really appreciate it, thanks. And look forward to it.
Great. Bye.
Nice to talk to you again, Sean.
Likewise. Thank you.
That was great, right, guys?
That was so fun.
So great. She's so awesome. I feel like I have to cut myself off because I would just keep talking to her and asking her questions. But I know she's got a city to help run, to counsel. She's also got a recall election to fight. But yeah, she's awesome. So guys, we still have a couple. I mean, the show isn't even over. Oh, Kate, what time do you have to leave by?
I gotta head out to my show in just a minute here.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna swap you in for another awesome person.
Good to see you.
Okay. Yeah, you
take
too. All right, bye. Professor Reed, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. Look, we match.
We do, don't we? Cool.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, the last time I was on with you, I had my sole experience of being a Twitter target for about 24 hours.
Oh yeah, you got in trouble, right? I mean, you often do, but I guess it was like a very quick turnover.
It was fucking ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing was, but
yeah,
because I'm not on Twitter, so I don't usually so I've never been part of this thing in my life, but just reading the comments.
Right. Oh, yeah. I think they were mad at you because you said something about Angela Nagel.
And just in passing, too.
Yeah.
And all I said was, what's his name? Klein.
Oh, Julius Klein.
Right.
Yeah.
And he got his ass on his shoulders and was.
They were trying to pretend you were an anti-Semite. That's what it was, because. Which was ridiculous because the whole point is, which I found very funny. So you can use me as your Jewish shield, but you were saying how you thought Julius Klein, that's his name, Julius Klein, right? From some right wing thing. You thought he was like an older Jewish, like neocon, but he turned out to be a younger Germanic.
Right.
Like
exactly.
Montanan or something. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
How was Sawant?
Good. She was great. Yeah. She was really great.
Yeah, good. I had to do a class for a friend of mine at Fordham, and like that went on for an hour and a half.
Thank you for making time for this.
Oh yeah, sure.
We should have you on another time because you would have a really cool debate, I think, about like Black Lives Matter, what is to be done, so to speak, about police.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone here probably already knows, but I'll give your official bio. Adolf Reed is professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, political scientist, editor of Nonsite. And he is the author of several books and articles. I'll just name some of the books: Class Notes, Posing as Politics and Other Thoughts on the American Scene, W.B. Du Bois and American Political Thought, Fabianism and the Color Line, The Jesse Jackson Phenomenon, The Crisis of Purpose in Afro-American Politics, and Stirrings in the Jug, Black Politics in the Post-Segregation Era.
Cool.
And so, welcome again. And yeah, did you see Biden's speech last night? Did you spare yourself? Because it was really painful and boring anyway.
Yeah, and I spared myself.
Yeah.
And I also spared myself the commentary.
Yeah.
So I don't even know. I mean,
didn't miss anything.
Yeah, I didn't think I did. I mean, when Jimmy Carter went up to Camp David, midway through his term, and he came back down showing Christopher Lash's "The Culture of Narcissism," and gave us a speech about how we need to lower our expectations and figure out how to do more with less. And what struck me was that the commentary from the network bigwigs, I think it was John Chancellor was one I stumbled on, was talking about shit like how, you know, Carter used to part his hair on the side like Bobby Kennedy, and now he's moved it up closer to the top like FDR to mark the severity of the moment. And I said, okay, I'm never watching this shit again.
Yeah. Right. Total waste of time. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah,
I'm trying to think of any of the funny moments. Oh, the best part was the response from Tim Scott.
Oh, Lord, I'm sure.
That was really funny, yeah. That was very entertaining.
What did he have to say?
What did he have to say? He talked about how he had been called the N-word by progressives, how this country isn't racist. He actually was kind of moving. He talked about how his grandfather would read the newspaper at the table but didn't know how to read, which actually I found moving because he wanted to set a good example for him. Mostly his voice is just incredibly annoying. He seems like like a school monitor type of kid. And I think that's, I mean, he really did play it up the China is bad, China competition, stuff. And, he did have one line justifying, intellectual property, Sarah Lazar, shout out to Sarah Lazar. She actually caught it. That's one of the things that that Sawant has done in Seattle. They passed a resolution like calling on Biden to, let basically people make vaccines, abroad, which is so dumb that that people are not doing that because like you just have to be self interested. You don't have to care about people, other countries.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But yeah, what are your thoughts on Biden's first 100 days? And what are your thoughts on, we had the Chauvin verdict.
Right.
Also, more crimes and more police murders that are coming to the surface. I very naively was kind of shocked that there was another person killed with the knee on the neck. I thought that, I guess there is no accountability. I don't know. You tell me your thoughts.
Well, I'm struck by that, too. I mean, but I guess this one had a knee on the back, I think, right? The big dude on the West Coast. I'll tell you, let me start with Biden and work back to that, because I think they're both important. I mean, Biden's first 100 days have been a lot better than a lot of us would have had hopes to expect, right? For my precinct, the labor law stuff that they're doing and the infrastructure spending, which has also some possible possible implications for giving us some more space with labor law, are good, and they give us breathing room, right? I mean, but I don't think it's I think it's important to think of it as temporary breathing room. Rather than putting us on the steps to transformation, of course. I just finished reading Adam Tooze's Crashed, and one of the things I came away from that with is a reinforced sense that the ruling class basically has an ideological commitment that's flexible enough, right? That they could get behind market fundamentalism when that worked for them, and then could permit sort of, I kind of hesitate to call these guys Keynesians, but like Rubin and. Brian Deese and even Larry Summers, who were never monetarist ideologues, and I think someplace between the Great Recession and the crash like in Europe a couple of years later, and the emergence of Trumpism, and then especially January 6th, has put enough of them in a position. Or I guess the best way to characterize it is that there was some of them out there who were inclined to accept that government should take the edges off of steep inequality, and that there's an underlying stagnation to the U.S. economy, if not the global economy. And what that means, just like it meant in 1940, is that government has a role to play. And I think, as one of them put it, in escorting capital to investment opportunities, right? So to create the conditions for unlocking private investment, okay? And what that means is that some of them will even are inclined to support strengthening the labor movement, right?
Right.
But they're not really committed to any deep sort of redistribution, or I doubt that they are, or to a serious reinvigoration of the public sector, for instance, right? I think that they're that they see the role of the public sector as clearing away log jams that that have impeded private capital, right? So if you look at it that way, I think it makes sense for us to breathe a sigh of relief that that Trumpism is over for the moment, and that enough of the ruling class that was concerned about Trumpism and authoritarian tendencies within nationalist neoliberalism to do something about it. Because for me, like until after January 6th, I thought it was an open question as to, because you know, the bourgeoisie is going to be okay, right, if the neoliberalism is democratic or if it's authoritarian. The downside of it is, you know, I suspect that one of the reasons that Brian Deese and that crowd have been able to get some space to operate, right, is that that they all are pretty convinced that they've defeated the left, right? Mm. So we aren't a problem anymore. So like, if we aren't a problem, the problem they're concerned about is Trumpism, and what that means is that they can make moves like the sort that they're making, and you not have to worry about any left insurgency that'll push them farther than they want to go.
Right.
So that's my take on Biden. Right. I mean, I'm as prepared to breathe a sigh of relief as anybody else, but you know, I don't think we're coming out of this with natural health care or with any of the other stuff that we need. And one of the concerns then is the extent to which people who see themselves as leftist or the kind of liberals who want to be reformists will put more faith and hope into the Biden administration than they should, and you know, we'll be back here again.
Right.
Right. I mean, like a friend of mine has been saying that this this pattern of where we can win some moderate social democratic light kind of reforms until the ruling class thinks it's gone too far and they'll take it away from us violently again. As my friend put it, that can go on until the sun burns out. Right.
Yeah.
So we'll see about Biden. I think they're improvising, which frankly is a good thing. I don't know. I mean, their policy on Latin America looks like it's going to be every bit as fucked up as their predecessors. They're prepared like to reinvigorate the Cold War. Right.
Right.
So there's more of that. I mean, and I guess one of the things in the spirit of Leo Panitch and Sam Gendin, one of the considerations is that, you know, Trump has managed to screw up I mean, the international order of things enough that I guess the Biden administration has as one of its priorities to reassert central role of the U.S. in maintaining the global system.
Yeah, and telling Haitians not to come here.
Right.
Right. Played a clip earlier. I don't know if you saw this, of Kamala Harris talking about the root causes of immigration from Central America. And she literally, you would love this. She like, it's like, you can't make it up. It was, climate change, like not having adaptability to climate change. It was like violence against, LGBTQ people, Afro descendants. I'll show it to you. I think this person blocked me. That's why I can't. Let's see. Okay, here it is. Yeah, can you not block me, Delonte? Brad, if I send it to you, can you play it? If you're logged in, I just can't because this person has blocked me. Okay, one second. More Twitter drama that you're luckily not exposed to. Okay, hold on.
Why did the person block you? This is a curiosity.
I don't know. I don't know what I've... I don't know. I mean, someone... That's a good question. I don't know why they blocked me. I don't know what I did wrong. But, who? Delonte. If you get offended by my tweets, just imagine what's in my drafts. Okay, fair warning.
Poverty and the lack, therefore, of economic opportunities, the issue of extreme weather conditions and the lack of climate adaptation, as well as corruption and the lack of good governance, and violence against women, indigenous people, LGBTQ people, and Afro-descendants.
That's the whole fucking country.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's... okay, also, now I get why... This is so funny. The person who tweeted that out wrote, Vice President Kamala Harris tells the Guatemalan president to his face that political corruption, violence against LGBT people and Afro-descendants are some of the root causes of migration to America. I kind of thought he, like, was criticizing her, but no, he was actually giving her props for being bold. And now I get why he blocked me. He's like a Kamala fan. And the reason I know that is because his banner picture is Kamala and Biden. And then his like pinned tweet is, oh my God, y'all, I just met Kamala Harris. Okay, now I get it. I really didn't understand it. I was like, why would someone who was making fun of Kamala Harris block me? But right. He was actually, you know.
Not making fun of her. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lord have mercy.
Yeah. So it's just like the best wokeification of imperialism.
That's truly amazing. I mean, so I don't know about you, but for the last 6 or 8 months, maybe, it's been almost a daily experience for me. Like, even though I know better, like things don't work this way, but it's been almost a daily experience that the daily expose, right, of the class character of this woke politics shit just seems to be getting more and more explicit and undeniable daily. And my impulse, which I know is wrong, is to think, maybe this will be the one.
I know.
It's a bridge too far. And
right.
And I know it's not, it's not only wrong, like I've written against it, right, for years. Because things don't work that way, but it's almost like a natural human tendency to think that they can't rationalize this one, and then it turns out they don't have to rationalize.
Yeah, right. Like because you get people tweeting like that guy did that was right. You know, a bold.
Yeah,
this is just to not to obsess over this, but here I just so you can actually see the text. I mean, it's just stunning. Mm-hmm. And this is from an article. So there are longstanding issues that are often called the root cause of immigration. We are looking at the issue of poverty and the lack, therefore, of economic opportunities, the issue of extreme weather conditions and the lack of climate adaptation, as well as corruption, the lack of good governance, and violence against women, indigenous people, LGBTQ people, and Afro-descendants.
Wow.
And and then what's also funny about that is just as that was a positive tweet, this was from an article at the Washington Blade, which said Harris anti-LGBTQ violence is a root cause of migration from Guatemala, which is not actually really, I mean, it was one of the many things she attributed it to, but it's funny that that's, yeah.
Wow, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And so I should have offered a trigger warning, by the way, to everyone watching, but yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, that's there, or that's a version of Trump's conspiracies, right? Look every place except what we've been doing here for the last years.
And it's like we obviously care about indigenous people, which is why we supported like the Contras,
right?
Care about women's rights, you know, right.
And Rios Mott, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, major, yeah. I mean, major Latin, yeah. Well, he was Latinx, so there you go.
Well, that's true.
We should just wokeify everyone, all of the foreign intervention. Yeah.
So speaking of the woke, in my friend's class, one of the students, they're generally pretty good. One was like a pure ideologue, but when this one guy asked me a question, like in my response to him, I mentioned something about Latinos, and I said, so I'm not going to use Latinx, because among other things, I mean, nobody in Latin America uses it, and it's like, and I take it as a form of linguistic imperialism. But a young woman who I think was the one who went on a privilege rant toward the end called out, "Yes, they do. You use it in Latin America." I'm thinking, come on, who the fuck are you kidding, right? I mean, maybe your friends, I'm not sure where.
Right.
It was from, but she felt she had a proprietary connection to be able to declaim on what people in Latin America or on how people in Latin America refer to themselves. But yeah, no, the wokeification is becoming incredible. Speaking of which, so the election in Ecuador, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I was intrigued to learn that Ecuador now has its own version of Brazil's Marina Silva, right? But the indigenous environmentalist dude, pro corporate, backed by the U.S.
Right,
helped to swing the election to the right winger, right? Every case of that is like an exception. So, right. And he's the bad one.
Right. Something that I want to ask you about is I didn't plan to ask you about this, but now that you mentioned the kind of the sigh of relief and the breathing room, what do you think would have happened under Trump? Like what would he have done had he stayed in
God
office?
Knows. And it's not so much Trump, but the people with more who were less lazy around him. I mean, if Trump has had another four years, the judiciary would be even worse, right?
Yeah.
But voter suppression would be worse. The pattern of appointments up and down in the federal government would be worse. And like my friends and I have been, joking with the gallows humor, right? Like, but a lot of us might be in jail, right? Mm. Right before the end of his second term. I normally don't think about that kind of stuff, but my solace, I've been saying to friends is that I'm assuming that when the roundup started, they would go first for the loudmouth posers on the internet, which because they're more conspicuous and like that might give the rest of us time to get a toiletries bag and head to Canada.
Right.
First
they went for the loudmouths on the internet and I didn't say anything because I was making a toiletries bag.
Yeah.
We make that post.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And we also spent a lot of time doing all kinds of versions of that too, by the way, bringing changes on Pastor Nemo.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, I think, and that's the other thing about it. I mean, the people who were, you know, I can't vote for Biden. I thought, okay, this is just not a serious politics, right? This is a performance of the self in public as a politics.
Yeah, you had the best slogan for people who are reluctant to vote for Biden, I think, which was some Biden Harris, because sometimes you got to clean the damn toilet.
Right. That's right. And that's all it is. That's all it ever could be. But I mean, yeah. And as I've said too, I mean, most of us who have voted have cast at least sometimes votes for people we couldn't stand. Right. I mean, like, the electoral realm isn't where you should go to, look to fulfill your greatest aspirations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you live in a safe state or whatever, then you can do whatever you want.
I voted for Ralph in 2000.
Yeah.
Because I lived in Connecticut.
Right.
And also, like, I decided, yeah, the only actual vote I've ever cast for a Republican in my life was in a Senate race in 1988 when Lowell Weicker was running against Lieberman. I mean, Weicker was the more progressive candidate, like on every issue. So, and I swore then I'm never going to vote for Lieberman, and I would have had to vote for Joe in 2000.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Right. The worst. Yeah. Yeah. And what are your thoughts now? Cause you were talking early on about like Black Lives Matter and how, you know, noteworthy it was that you had these pretty evil corporations, mm-hmm. Like donating or virtue signaling. What do you think? I mean, what has been done? Has anything like good come out of it? How would you describe the movement now? Almost a year after the
right.
Protests.
Well, first thing is, like, I was always very reluctant to call it a movement because it didn't satisfy my understanding of what a movement is. I mean, that's what these things are now. I mean, I don't. It's funny. Like the Obama thing, right? Like, my son was just telling me that there's a little Eddie, maybe, of people on the internet who think I'm especially prescient, because of the Obama thing. And like, I just have to be around and keep your eyes open.
Was that in the Village Voice that you wrote that?
Yeah. It's the same with the BLM stuff. Like, you can look at it and see what it is, right? There's no movement there. There are precedents, right? And I saw the whole thing, I mentioned this someplace not too long ago as well, like there's the cycle of authenticity, the product cycle basically of authenticity with that kind of politics, it always makes me think of the commercial or industrial logic of gangster rap in the early 90s. Right, like a group comes up out of nowhere, off the streets of Brooklyn, the Bronx, right, Oakland, whatever, and they're authentically expressing the angst and the rage and the revolutionary fervor of inner city youth, and selling all those records like to upper middle class white kids in the suburbs. They do what any artist wants to do. They get a larger audience and they cross over. Well, crossing over becomes the spur to kick off the next cycle, right? because the group that successfully crosses over is there to be defined as sellouts by the next one coming up. And then they repeat the cycle and stuff. So to take that back to Black Lives Matter, the first powerful voice was, I'm blacking on his name.
DeRay?
Right. I mean, DeRay McKesson. Like, my son just started calling him Stingray McGillicuddy. Oh. And that's just stuck in my head. I couldn't get, DeRay in for a minute. So he was the authentic voice of Black Lives Matter till he wasn't, right? Till people started accusing him of commercializing it. So then the three women who founded the movement by creating the hashtag. Well, in the first place, you don't found a movement, right? There's no individual that founds a movement. That's like, a 1939 John Garfield movie version of what a revolution is.
Right.
A guy shows up, rips his shirt off, gets on top of the car with a bullhorn, and then the people rise.
Yeah. Right?
Or like the Arab Spring or Occupy, they're all versions of the same thing. But then, like, I was in a faculty discussion group about this, about what the teaching after Black Lives Matter. But one of my colleagues, who's a very smart person, said, it's very important for us to acknowledge that this movement was, this hashtag was created by these three queer Black women. And I wasn't even trying to be contentious. It was just like an innocent question. I said, well why? What's important about that, right? Because it just seems to me, and I didn't say this to my colleague, but it always seemed to me like that was a branding exercise, right? And then I saw the three of them on a panel someplace on TV, and I was really kind of freaked out because in watching Garza speaking, it was very clear that to her, advancing her or their brand and building a movement or advancing a movement were like two sides. No, they weren't even two sides of the same coin. They were identical. It was the same thing. And I thought, okay, some of this might be naivete about politics, but no matter what, if the reality is that we've gotten to a point now where some people find it impossible to consider that personal careerism and broad political goals or pursuit of broad political goals aren't necessarily the same thing. Or people can't imagine that, then we're in really bad shape. And from there you could just kind of predict where it's going, right? But it's not like you need to be a swami or Nostradamus, right? I mean, you just put the pieces together and, I mean, consider, the industrial logic that's at work. Among other things, you notice that, like, all of the powerful voices are people who are polished and ready for MSNBC. And you can kind of see how things going. And like, this is what the politics is at this point. That's what got me primed, right? Like in the midst of the lockdown, after George Floyd's murder, to see like one announcement after another from a bevy of the most reprehensible big corporations in America. Stepping up and kicking in to the Racial Justice Fund and to Black Lives Matter, right, to the tune of just a biscuit short of $2 billion, right, in the span of a couple of weeks. And then Goldman Sachs, that well-known like defender of human justice,
right,
gender justice all over the world, kicks up $10 billion or $16 billion to help Black women create businesses. I mean, but none of that matters. And then you get to the really trivial stuff, right? Like the contretemps over whether Chadwick Boseman was the front runner for a posthumous Oscar. Well, what does any of that mean? I mean, how can it be a front runner? It was obviously an attempt to kind of talk it into existence. But more importantly, beyond that, and like this is what I mean, some in the audience might think this is me taking a break from beating up on Ava DuVernay, but why should anybody care whether Chadwick Boseman wins an Oscar, dead or alive? Right? I mean, it brings to mind a comment that Langston Hughes made about the Harlem Renaissance. And he said, actually, most Negroes in Harlem, I've never heard of the Harlem Renaissance, and if they did, it didn't raise their wages any, right? So,
right.
But here we are, and that's what politics is. My close comrades and I talk about this stuff almost on a daily basis about how much time it makes how much sense it makes to dedicate time to paying attention to what goes on like in the nominal left and its discursive worlds and whether there's any reason to do it at all. And,
Yeah. I mean,
not much.
Is there just before we get back to the Black Lives Matter question, mm-hmm. So the Harlem Renaissance obviously produced amazing stuff. So right. Is it about distinguishing between that and a real working class, a movement that's serious about class and about serious about exploitation? Yeah. But they're not totally distinct, right? Because you do have some intellectual, even if people don't know about necessarily, mm-hmm. James Baldwin, there is some back and forth between cultural and material worlds.
And you're going back to the Harlem Renaissance itself. People Hughes.
Right.
Sterling Brown, some of the artists Aaron Douglas and others. So I mean, but it's not that so much as that. And it's good to have. It's good you give me an opportunity to try to make this distinction. And so I'm kind of doing it on the fly. Well, I'm trying to specify it a little bit on the fly, but it's partly the difference between a cultural movement, right, that was more or less indirectly, more or less or organically linked to a political insurgent moment as well as a culturally insurgent moment, right, like from the mid-30s, actually, which is a little later than the Renaissance, technically speaking, versus this thing that we've had for the last 25 or 30 years that projects cultural performance as a political movement.
Right.
And I mean, this was another long-standing beef. Like, that's funny. Like the only music writing I've ever done was, I forget who approached me to do this. Oh, it was a music editor, and I'm blacking on her name now. It might come to me later. At The Voice, mm-hmm. who approached me to write a review of the soundtrack to who did this thing?
I'm looking it up. I'm trying to look it up to see if I can.
Well, the title of the piece was, I think, Half a Story Told. It was a two or three part thing on Ted Turner's network on the Great Migration, and I think what's his name from Hampshire might have been the person responsible for. But anyway, like I wrote it. And I mean, well, one of the points I made in that was like, well, you know, the thing is that there's this.
Wait, it wasn't What Are the Drums Saying, Booker? Is it
no,
that?
No. This was an entirely different piece for an entirely different section. In fact, I did one music bit and one sports piece for during my time at The Voice. And both times it was just that the respective section chief just got the idea that he or she thought it'd be interesting to see what I would do with it. So like the sports guy didn't know that I was a basketball fan. Right. So that was an article comparing Kobe Bryant and Allen Iverson, and the cultural mythology they were trying to sell it on to them. Kobe was, you know, squeaky clean, and Allen was a hood thug. And the editor liked the piece, but he was totally surprised by what it was. But anyway, this music thing was, I pointed out that, you know, there's this notion that had gotten out into the world that the music of popular music was a central motor in the civil rights and post-civil rights black struggle. And that's kind of turning reality on its head, right? Because a number of the songs that subsequently got vested with deep political significance were pop songs that the movement took over, right? And invested them with that significance, like Aretha Franklin's Bridge Over Troubled Water. And there were others like that too. But it's just kind of weird because you can see the shift away from seeing politics as seeing political action, right, and organizing, building bases and broadening them as what makes change happen, right? So like you could imagine then that, you know, people would, you know, sit around and listen to change is going to come and get up and say, yeah, that's right. Change needs to come. So that's right. Fucking crazy.
Great Sam Cooke song.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's a great Sam.
Yeah, yeah.
Sam Cooke song. And it was, well, it wasn't that one. Cause that was one of his last, but there was one actually, one version of his song, Good News, had a verse in it. Something like, well, I hear they're marching in Montgomery or something.
Oh, yeah.
Or Birmingham, maybe. I forget which one. But I mean, there were things like that. But the more self-consciously political and critical popular songs came out after the crest of the movement, right? Because, I mean, I remember at the time, like, Edwin Starr War song that was ostensibly like an anthem of the anti-war movement. It was all right. But though, like, there was a significant segment of the anti-Vietnam War movement that was to the left of the sensibility in that song. And people would turn up their noses at verses like, you know, they say we must fight to keep our freedom, but God knows the Lord knows there's got to be a better way. Mm-hmm. That was not a radical line in 1969 and 1970.
Right.
But anyway, I'll go on about that bullshit. But
no, I love it. This is really interesting.
But there's an argument. So, and it would make sense, right, from a materialist perspective, that the state of the struggle would call forth the artistic the artistic expressions that were consonant with it, right? And not the other way around. But by the end of the 80s, you know, after the left had had all gone to university. The order of things gets reversed, and I guess now that I reflect on it, right, that's because of people who wrote music and studied music and studied the study of music were writing the narratives, basically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, what one of my dad's sayings that I always loved was, the story of the lion hunt would be a different tale if the lion had a typewriter.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, that's one thing we forget about this stuff.
Right. Speaking of which, just mentioning your dad, I got to ask, people ask this frequently. So tell us about the name Adolf.
Well, I have said to a couple of young Beavis and Butthead guys and the Butthead guys who have written me I'm out of the blue on the email to ask about that. And my response has been, so what part of junior do you not get?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. And my father was born in 1921. And he was at D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. He wasn't happy about being either one of them. But when the war was over, he was more concerned on labeling what he giving his label to what he assumed to be his DNA than he was about Hitler. Because in his mind, anyway, he had had the name a good 15 years before Hitler had it.
Yeah, shouldn't let that guy ruin a good name.
Right. Totally not. Yeah. But also, I mean, since we moved around a fair amount when I was a kid, I'll credit it with a couple of things, like the name, and like I was never somebody who sought the spotlight for anything. Right? I was always kind of a shy kid, and like most kids, I didn't want to be the center of attention ever. So from that perspective, like the name.
So then you change your name legally to Benito.
Oh, right. Exactly. In some ways that would have worked better.
Yeah.
I would have had a lot more Italian friends and a non Italians would have known. But like it gave me a certain humility, and it also taught me how to fight and that I couldn't avoid fighting.
Right? It's like a boy named Sue.
When that song came out when I was in college, I instantly was drawn
That's
to
really
it.
Funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I was all made off. Yeah. I was just curious if your dad, I mean, I don't mean this in a judgmental way. Like, did he think to himself like, oh, I guess I'm curious what it was like then also, if it was established enough of a name and Hitler was recent enough of a person so that it hadn't been like Hitlerized?
Oh no, it was totally Hitlerized.
It was. Okay. So yeah, did your dad was he like, did he think about it?
No.
He didn't. Yeah.
No. That didn't cross his mind. The one place in the country where I've seen the name commonly enough, well, like you see it in the New York area, like in one way, but you see it like in South Louisiana another way too, because like there's a French name, so
right,
and it's common enough that I mean they didn't associate with Hitler,
so. Right.
So I mean I actually got less of that in South Louisiana than I got like in other places that we lived.
Yeah. And then
now there was a moment when my son was about three where he was genuinely hurt that he wasn't Adolf the Third. And I said to him, that'll change.
Yeah, you're going to grow out of that.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. That's really funny, yeah. What is his name based on?
His name is based on the trade union and the independence movement leader in French Guinea. And Guinea was the only country in the French Empire. Like when the French held a referendum right among their remaining colonies with three options, right, to become a department of France, like Martinique and Guadeloupe, and what would they would have preferred for Algeria, to remain in the Francophone Imperial Federation or complete independence. And Guinea was the only country that opted for complete independence.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, that was that.
Yeah. Guinea would have been problematic too.
Yes. Well, kind of the same way that Benito would have been, but not exactly.
Yeah, not exactly. Well, I had a boyfriend whose name was Quique for Jorge.
Oh, my
Quique.
God.
And usually it's spelled Q-U-I-Q-U-E, but this one's right. Name was spelled K-I-K-E.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine me text, like, I would text people, like, I'm coming with K-I-K-E.
It was
really funny.
Yeah, I think you should have opted for a different spelling.
I know. I tried to encourage that, yeah. He was born and raised in Colombia, so he didn't have the context.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen Quicos and Quiques in Central America, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, after all, what is Colombia except like a big grassy extension of Central America?
Mm. No. I actually have never been there. I really want to go.
Yeah. No, I haven't either. So
we can do a Katie Halper Show live taping there.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That'd be great.
And what are you working on now? How is retirement?
Okay. I'm finally starting to get it figured out. I've actually got a book finished and it should be going into production, in the first part of May. Actually with Verso. And I've got three smaller co-authored books that also are going to be finished, I hope, by the end of the summer. One with Walter Ben Michaels and one with Ken Warren. And shit, who's the third with? I know, it's a different project. My next objective is to finish my long-suffering book with Verso on the decline and transformation of the left since the end of World War II. And all four of those should be done by the end of the calendar year.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, which would be a relief.
Great, awesome, yeah. Thank you. And we'll look out for your pieces and then have you on. Yeah, I'm excited.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know that I'm done with the New Republic, right?
No.
Yeah, I mean, well, they fired Chris Lehman, the editor, who brought me on, and they replaced him with Michael Tomasky, which somebody referred to as a fantasy or as being connected with Biden's election, because they imagine being what somebody referred to, or being once again as a in-flight reading on Air Force One, like they were in the Clinton administration.
Right.
So yeah, so I'm done. Like my last column was my last column, basically.
Which was that?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll send you a link to it.
Okay.
Or I'll send a PDF because it was kind of a fit. A fitting one, pardon me. It was a call for a public good approach to government.
Oh, okay, yeah.
All right.
Wow. It's like right now. It's now.
Yeah,
now.
Right.
All right, we're gonna have to do another interview with you because I'm embarrassed to say I didn't see that.
Oh, that's fine.
So yeah, we're going to have to do it. We're going to have to, well, invite Tomasky on to give his feedback.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it'd be cool to do it with Chris.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Anyway, no, it's your show. I'm not making.
No, let's do it. Yeah. I didn't hear you at first. I thought you said grist.
Oh, sorry.
Like, grist for the mill. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, here's the article. Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. We'll have to do that. Yeah, we could do a Nadal Reed book club or article club. Yeah. Tomasky from the Daily Beast.
Right.
Oh, he defended, wasn't he like calmed down about Hillary Clinton and Kissinger? wrote that about him once.
I mean, that's Tomasky, right? He's been like that for a long time.
Wow.
So Chris actually told me that that if I wanted him to, he would put in a word for me to keep the column. And I said, well, look, I mean, A, I came in with you. I should leave with you. Like what he did with it was got me, as well as a number of other people whom I've heard this from, to read the magazine, who haven't read it in more than 30 years. Right. And then I thought, there's no way I would be Tomasky's cup of tea.
Right. Wow. You should have done it like undercover. Share screenshots of his edits or whatever.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been great. And we'll do it again soon.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Bye. Good night. Thanks again for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, Nick Palm. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman, and our intern is Maria Trujillo. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.